Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Agla, and I'm the host of UEG Talks, educational, hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. We're happy to have you with us for another exciting episode. And today is a very special one, and the first-year resident in me is just overwhelmed with excitement. Today's guest is a titan in endoscopy, prolific researcher, innovator, educator, entrepreneur, and chief of one of the biggest hospitals in the world, a legend who does not need any introductions, Professor Nageshwar Reddy. Welcome to UG Podcast, Professor.
Thank you, Aggie. Thank you very much.
We're so happy to have you with us today. So let's dive in. Today we're talking about endoscopy and how it changed through the years. So for you personally, what is the biggest breakthrough in endoscopy?
Actually, for me, the biggest breakthrough was not now. It occurred about maybe 60 years back when fiber optic endoscopy actually came. Because you're now transiting from a rigid endoscopy to a fiber optic endoscopy, which totally changed the whole game plan for endoscopies. And I think that to me was the single most important breakthrough in endoscopy. Since then, incremental steps have occurred, like a video endoscope, image enhancements in the endoscope, better optics, better channels so that you can do a lot of procedures, and a whole new lot of accessories that came. And on the side, we also had capsule endoscopy and the developments occurring there. So it's actually fundamentally the change from a rigid to fiber optic endoscopy, which changed the whole way that endoscopy progressed. If that single didn't occur, we would have never gone to the stage we are now.
Okay, so you can't define one single breakthrough.
No, the breakthrough was the fiber optic endoscopy. It looks very ancient now. For people like me who are also ancient, we realize as we look through this transition that this was the single most important point which caused the transition. And then, of course, that it's been very incremental. In fact, I remember when the videoscopes came, we were very reluctant to use that.
Why?
In the 80s, late 80s, because we all used to looking through the fiber optic. It gave an intimate feeling between yourself and the mucosa and the papilla. We were actually looking at it ourselves. But the disadvantage was everybody around were not able to see it. Of course, whenever the professor said, look, this is a difficult papilla, we all thought it was a difficult papilla. But only when the video came, everybody else could judge what you're doing. So that was major advantage. Videoscope was not that actually it improved your precision, but actually it improved the ability for other people to see what's happening in the room. And when they started seeing it, you know, they have, of course, multiple opinions and people are telling you this is where this is. And also, accessories, helping with the accessories became easier. Otherwise, I remember as assistants, because when I started, it was fiber optic. And I used to assist my professor with ERCPs. It was us together just pushing the guide wire, not knowing what was happening inside. It was a very boring job. But now everybody is involved, everybody is interested. So it became quite interesting. So that's the single most important thing that a videoscope did. But in the last maybe 10 years, endoscopic manufacturers have started thinking about increasing the image enhancement, quality of image. These things definitely have now made a difference in terms of third space endoscopy. For ERCP, there is no difference. But if we're looking at third space endoscopy, ESDs, and so on, then you require a much better image. So this is the next evolution is going to be how to include all this into disposable scopes, because we are now talking about a lot of environmental factors and all. So disposable scopes with enhanced imaging is the next challenge that manufacturers are going to have.
So regarding the disposable or single-use endoscopes, what's your opinion? Because actually, medical field is one of the most contributing factors to environmental pollution. So where is the place here? Of course, hygiene is on one side, but the environmental impact is on the other.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with you. Of course, hygiene is important. But if you're talking about routine endoscopy like colonoscopy or upper GI, hygiene is not so important in the sense that you're not breaching the vessels going into the vascular system. So it's predominantly limited to that. And we know anyway, gut has a lot of bacteria itself, so it doesn't make a difference. It's in when you're doing invasive procedures like ERCP or US, hygiene comes into factor. And we, of course, know that the two companies have introduced disposable ERCP scopes, which haven't taken off as they expected, mainly because of the factor of the cost, the environmental factors now. So unless you get a bio-friendly endoscopes, disposable endoscopes are going to add a lot into this problem of carbon footprints being added into the environment. So my feeling is that this is going to be confined to certain small centers, especially in the Western countries. But more importantly, we did a very interesting study recently along with a group in Netherlands, Marco Bruno, Italy, Repici, and with Pittsburgh. What we did is we looked at bacteria in the gut, how much antibiotic resistant bacteria were there. And we found surprisingly that in a country like India, 83% of patients coming for ERCP already had a gut resistant bacteria, antibiotic resistant bacteria in their gut. So what's the point in using a disposable scope? Whereas in a country like Netherlands, it was 10%, Italy 20%, in US it was again same 20%. So this was published in Lancet recently. And what we concluded from this is, at least in emerging nations or where there's economy, there's resources are not so good, in these cases, there's absolutely no point in using disposable scopes. I know that I'm going to have problems with the companies, but this is what I feel.
Well, it is what it is. But why do you think it is? Because Italy, for instance, is one of the most predominantly antibiotic-resistant countries in Europe, and it's only 20%. And why do you think India is such an outlier in this case in antibiotic resistance?
Yeah, this is a very important point. We actually looked at it carefully. And one, of course, in India, antibiotics are prescribed over the counter. You don't have to get a doctor's prescription. Any patient can go and I want amoxicillin, the pharmacist gives it to him. So this is one problem. The second problem is that a lot of people are very anxious and take antibiotics unnecessarily. So viral fever, for example, you have fever of 1 day or 2 days, you just wait it out and goes off. They don't. First day of fever, they go and take an antibiotic. The third important thing is they're taking incomplete courses. They don't take the full 5 day or 7 day course. They take it for 1 day, 2 days, they're feeling better, they stop it. So these are the medical reasons. But there's also something outside medicine. And that is, we now know that a lot of antibiotics are used in animal husbandry, agriculture. And therefore, what is happening is that even in the food that we use, even vegetables, there are a lot of antibiotics. So when we actually looked at the patients or people coming for procedures who had this drug-resistant bacteria, they hadn't visited a doctor, they hadn't taken antibiotics, but because from the food source, right from agriculture, milk and other things, they were getting these antibiotic-resistant issues. So I think this is a big problem in India. The government is very actively looking into this. Just a month ago, our Prime Minister addressed the whole nation asking people not to taking antibiotics unnecessary and telling doctors, be careful, prescribe it only in certain. So it's become a big issue. So when you actually relate this along with the disposable scopes, you realize that it's a different problem altogether from the West. We actually at present have to tackle a larger problem than just looking at disposable scopes.
Well, forgive me for my lack of knowledge in this area, but would the restriction of antibiotic use would be a solution for this problem, or is it just not feasible due to rural areas there? The patients might not find the doctor in time when they really need antibiotics.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a complex problem, Aglaya. What I think involves is not only the government administration, the mentality of people, doctors and so on. So if you restrict antibiotics very strongly, like what happens with narcotics. In India, narcotics are very well controlled. We don't have people on unnecessary narcotics and all. Government has a thing called Schedule X, which all the narcotics, the hospitals have to keep, the pharmacy has to keep a record. So no problem. Very restricted and it's very well regulated. So I have actually suggested to the government that antibiotics also should come under Schedule X so that it's very restricted. So I think this is a problem we have to tackle very harshly. The second issue here is because the complexity is that agriculture and animal husbandry poultry, they're using antibiotics a lot. So this is a very complex issue. It's a political issue. How they can control antibiotic there, we'll have to see. So it's not an easy problem to solve. But one important thing to remember is that maybe many years back, 30, 40 years back, if you looked at this problem in, say, Netherlands, antibiotic resistance was 30%. They've got it down to 10% now. So we have an historical background which says that probably in India, if you're very strict, and hopefully the government is going to go into this, we can reduce antibiotic resistance problem. I know we diverted from the actual thing, but this is a very important issue for us currently.
Of course, and who could have found that choosing the duodenoscope will depend on your governmental policies in regards to antibiotics? Yeah, it's a complex problem. But full disclosure, I have watched a lot of interviews with you, and you had a very interesting surrounding when you were growing up, going back to Alexander Fleming. And I would like to ask, like, who was the most inspiring medical figure in your life? Or who would you consider to be biggest influence on your career?
Of course, there are many medical figures who influenced me in endoscopy, especially like Peter Cotton, Nip Sohendra and so on, Michel Kramer. But to me, the most influential person in my life, medical person, was my doctor, was my father. My father was a pathologist. He was a very eminent pathologist. He was low middle class in terms of our economical situation. So, but he was a very person of very high integrity. And when I took up gastroenterology and started practice, I was doing very well economically. And you know, when somebody comes from a low middle class, he wants to make a lot of money, make the family happy and so on. So I started doing that, and then he called me one day home for lunch and told me, son, you're a total failure in life. I said, what do you mean failure? I did a top specialty. He said, no, that's not success. Success is, have you built institutions? Have you taught any students? Have you published any papers? Have you done any work for poor patients? I had done nothing. I realized then that I was really a failure in the sense that he looked at the world. I changed immediately. I decided no more. I stopped my practice. We started this. Fortunately, we got a lot of donors to help us, giving us this Asian Institute Gastroenterology building. Built up a team of like-minded people. Started publishing. Starting a lot of free patients we used to treat. Go into community with vans and do endoscopy there and treat our patients. All this has given me an immense satisfaction. And of course, my father is no more. But when I look back, I realize what he said is absolutely true. I would have made much more money probably, but not happiness. And I think true happiness comes from doing what you think is the right thing.
Okay, so this was your father's definition of success when you were in your 30s. So have you adopted his definition of success?
Yes, yes. So whenever I go to conference, sometimes I'm asked to give talks on how to be successful. So I ask people to raise their hands because they think I'm successful. So I'll say, who's more very rich, who's most powerful, who's... Then you'll see some hands raising. Then I tell them, that's not success. Success is doing something which you like doing. And how many of you are successful in that sense? So that changes the whole definition of success for people. You know, unless you're doing what you like doing, you're not successful.
Okay. So, but this is the end goal, to do what you want to do, what makes you happy, and also contribute to the society. But what does it take for an endoscopist to be successful? What do you consider to be cornerstones to build this?
Yeah, so I think that's a very important question. So what should an endoscopist think? What should be the future? The first important thing is the passion. Unless you have passion for doing certain things, you should not do it. In fact, I often, when I'm selecting people for our institution, I look at two things. How passionate is he about what he wants to do? Second is how compassionate is he? So we forget that endoscopists start acting like technicians and they lose a compassion for the patient. So it's very important to have a compassion for the patient. And then, of course, passion for what you're doing. For me, for example, when I started early, I wanted to be a hepatologist. But I found that hepatology was getting a little boring. That I enjoyed doing mechanical things like cannulating a papilla gave me more enjoyment than reading all these hepatology papers. So I decided that I should train track and I became an endoscopist. So I think basically those who are endoscopists are those who have a hand-size skill that gives them passion to do things what they're doing. Most of them actually would make good carpenters or plumbers, I think. So we are like that. Fortunately, in the last few years, there's some amount of academic contents added to endoscopy. You start getting randomized controlled trials and evaluating endoscopy in a more rigid fashion. Otherwise, before, at least when I started endoscopy, it used to be like procedures. How many procedures you do? What can you do? What extent you can do? But it's changed now. So a person who wants to go into endoscopy should first have passion for doing those procedures. Second, should have a little surgical mind, you know, not get worried about complications, how to manage them and so on. The second most important thing. Otherwise, if you get complicated, you're too sensitive about certain complications, you can't proceed further. Third important thing is that he should be able to work hard in the sense, work extra hours. Endoscopy is not like regular. You can't fix your consultation up to 5 o'clock and then move up. You sometimes do procedures which go on till 7, 8 o'clock. So you have to have a situation where you're capable of working hard. But I tell them, my fellows are going to take endoscopy also. His hard work is very difficult. People can't do it. So you have to be very smart. Convert your hard work into smart work. So you start enjoying your work. When you start enjoying your work, it becomes smart work. It's no longer hard work. So you have to work smart. You have to have a passion. And most important is you must have compassion for your patient. That's very important. And nowadays, endoscopy has become complex. In my time, we used to do everything. We used to do third space, ERCP. Now, I think you have to also be mentally fixed towards become a specialist in certain area. It's very narrow. Ultimately, you become a good third space endoscopist or a pancreatic or biliary endoscopist. Things like endohepatology are coming now. So you have to subspecialize to be really good in that area. So I think all these factors should be considered when a person wants to take up endoscopy as a career.
Now, a quick message from UEG. Want to boost your gastro knowledge? Then GutFlix is the place to be. GutFlix is an interactive learning platform for GI professionals. Get access to expert-led online courses, UEG Week recordings, mistakes in articles, and more. Best of all, GutFlix is free. Log on today at gutflix.eu.
Okay, so you touched upon glorified plumbers, endoscopists as technicians that could substitute for carpenters. But this was, let's say, a concept for many, many years that we are just plumbers. But what do you think with recent advances, where are we going with endoscopy in the context of the entirety of medicine? Are we still technicians who just take out the stones?
So we are still technicians, but we are thinking technicians. You know, we have started now thinking about, for example, if you have a CBD stone, gallstone, should you be doing an ERCP or should you do a combined procedure? A surgeon could do lap and then remove those stones. We are also starting to think about, say, for example, a third space endoscopy now, which patients will be eligible for doing a ESD or even now intramuscular dissections. A lot of discussions now going on how deep we can cut full thickness resections. So a lot of thinking has to going into that. Plus, now we have randomized controlled trials. We used to think that the best thing for hilar strictures is to put in metal stents. We know this has changed now. We know that maybe a plastic stent with local ablative therapy like RFA and chemotherapy may be better than just putting metal stents and leaving the patient. So we're starting to think. So the major change that as an endoscopist now is not just that technically doing things, but they're also looking carefully at what happens, the outcome of these results. So I think there is a definite change, a shift in plus, of course, artificial intelligence has come in now. And this is another thing that's going to make a difference, that we start thinking we all to apply artificial intelligence and how it can help us as endoscopists to do better things.
Yeah. What about the kinds of futuristic new inventions like stem cell application for closures, things like that? Are we becoming supernatural in this case?
No, I think regenerative endoscopy is an extremely interesting concept that is coming in. And of course, you know the work that's going on in Italy, in Ivo Bosco's unit, they have done a lot of work and we have actually followed them now. We have a large number of cases where we take out these stem cells, not just stem cells, we take out the stem cells with vasoactive factors from the fat, either abdominal fat or thigh fat. We concentrate this, and now we are starting to use this, injecting it into fistulas, and dramatic closure. Even large fistulas, openings up to 2 centimeters, we will be able to close the regenerative medicine. So I think another additional dimension is coming to endoscopy, and this is very exciting. And then I think the endoscopy, we don't do this mechanically. We start studying the physiology of what is happening, how these stem cells are regenerating, what are the vasoactive factors that are coming in. Very exciting data. And for me, even being a mechanical endoscopist, I find this basic science concept very interesting. So I want to go more into this. So I think these are very exciting times for the endoscopist.
Does being a son of a pathologist come into it, all the cells?
Yeah, so I think this also, in fact, I had my heart in pathology. I specialized in pathology for a short period of time till my dad, who was a pathologist, got me kicked out of the department, not the hospital, because he said, pathologists don't have future, only clinicians have future. I think he was right in that sense. As a pathologist, you are always hidden behind. Whatever you do, people don't realize. So I was asked to leave the department and take up medicine then. That's how I took up medicine.
So he just kicked you out?
Yes, he just kicked me out. I mean, so I got actually admitted into a very big pathology school, one of the biggest one in the country, in the north, in Chandigarh. And the professor there was a friend of my father. I admitted myself without telling him whom I am. So they admitted me. And later when he came to know who I was, he spoke to my father, who said, get that fellow out of your department immediately. And then I had to again restart with medicine. So I have a long pathology link because both my grandfather, maternal and paternal, were pathologists. My paternal grandfather was a very famous pathologist. Invented a lot of things. He was a close friend of Alexander Fleming, who whenever he used to come to India, would stay in his house. And he used to like Indian food a lot. So my grandmother was an expert. So she would cook Indian food for him. And that was an attraction.
Good. But that's the first time I've heard someone being kicked out so they could have a future. That's a good reason.
No, I think that's right. Now, looking back, I think what he did, he was a pathologist. He recognized that however good you are, it's very difficult to be recognized. There are very rare instances like, I know, Barry Marshall and Robbins. Robin was a pathologist who ultimately got the Nobel Prize for H. pylori discovery. But that's very unusual. Most pathologists are not too recognized now.
Yeah, but as an endoscopist, I always appreciate pathologist input.
Yeah, I think we owe a lot to pathologists. Pathology is an extremely important specialty for the endoscopist, because I think now we are working together. To some extent, I also feel that we as endoscopists should also become a little pathologist. Because using cytoscope, now we started using all these magnification endoscopes. And especially when we're using the cytoscopes, we used to call the pathologist a room and along with him watch this pathology and explain to us whether these cells are abnormal and so on. So I think still that's going to come, that we are going to be endoscopic pathologists in future. Branch is going to come out. So that's a very important part. But a pure pathologist, unfortunately, doesn't have access to the patients. And that's a limitation that is there.
True. Professor, finishing up with the first part of our talk and finishing up with the innovations, you do have your own stent. Could you please retell the story of how it came about?
Yeah, this is called the Nagi stent. And first disclaimer is I don't get any royalty from this.
How come?
Yeah, so what happened was in 2011, when you're doing ERCPs at that time, US was still not very common. So we used to drain the peripancreatic fluids with a side-wing endoscope. Wherever there's a bulge, we'd make an opening and then put plastic stents. Then we started trying this. At that time, we didn't have covered biliary stents too. We just put standard biliary stents. So there's a lot of limitation there. I worked on this and I actually created a small stent. It's called the biflange stent. It's a biflange stent, but not lumen opposing. Because at that time, I wanted to have a stent which is very short stem, large opening, and big flanges so it doesn't move. Using this stent, we started draining peripancreatic fluids very easily just through a side-wing scope. So it started with side-wing scope, and later endosonologists took it up. So this was the first publications we did in 2012, 2013. At the same time, simultaneously, Ken Binwala was developing his lumen opposing stent, which had another concept. It was actually for gallbladder, not for pancreatic fluids, whereas mine was for pancreatic fluids. A company in Korea called the Taewoong Company was very interested in the drawing. They said, shall we develop the stent? At that time, the controls are not so much and so on. They just made this stent in a week's time with nitinol, with covering, and then got it to me. We just took our local ethical committee permissions. We didn't need to have government permissions and all at that time. And we started using this stent. The only thing I made it clear at that time also to them is that we should not patent this. Because once you patent it, all these problems come up, the other people can't duplicate. So it was not patented. It is called the Nagi stent. And of course, thousands have been deployed all across Asia now. It was very cheap. And in our country, that was the most commonly used stent till recently for peripancreatic fluids. And of course, now they made another version of it called the hot Nagi stent. So people in the department call it the hot Nagi now. It's now, earlier on, it used to be cold. We had to make an opening, dilate the balloon and go. Now a hot Nagi, you can go in directly. As retrospectively look back, this stent actually has advantage over the lumen opposing stent because it doesn't compress the mucosa. The incidence of bleeding as a complication after this stent is much less than with the standard stents. Of course, the disadvantage is that many people are now duplicated. There are many stents in this part of our world where this same stent has been duplicated by different companies. Doesn't matter. I think the important thing is that people are now receiving a good stent at a low cost without having to look for patents and things like that. So I feel very satisfied that this is sort of in a space that was there. It has been very helpful for patients, especially those who can't afford. And we still use a lot of Nagi stents in our department. So I think to me, that has again been something which is very satisfying.
You're living up to your father's expectations and also have a very great name, Hot Nagi. It's like a superhero.
In fact, when the stent sometimes is displaced, so our people used to salvage and you can get it, put it back. So there was a large paper they had, the title was How to Salvage Nagi.
A good one. Thank you, Professor. We will wrap the first part here because we still have a lot to cover. And we'll see you in a bit.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.